I gave a sermon here. It wasn't a PowerPoint, probably one of the last ones I ever gave anywhere that wasn't a PowerPoint. And if you remember the title, if you happen to have been here or wherever it was, the title was Waters of Chaos. And I have given that particular sermon many times since then. I won't say many, lots of times. I don't know how many it's been. And I have changed so much in the sermon that I've decided, and I have a follow-up to it, that I decided I'm going to give it again here, even though I gave it. And it's not just giving it again. It is, it's probably two-thirds different than what it was 4 years ago. So if you do remember some of it, that's fine, and I apologize if it seems like a repeat, but there's a lot of new stuff in here, and it's the next time I speak, there will be a follow-up to this that I think is even more important, but without this background, the follow-up won't make as much sense. So I want to go through it again, and I'll try to skim past some of the things that I know were in it the last time. I opened up last time when I gave this, I opened up with some verses in Job, but this time I want to go all the way back to the beginning. When we read the account, and I've said this before, but I think you can't go back to Genesis often enough. The earth was formless and void. So you know, the first part of the book of Genesis gives us a picture, paints a picture, and it gives us, this is how it was, and here's what God did. And that's, to me, it's very interesting. The earth was formless and void. It was not good for anything, okay? And God, it says, the Spirit of God moved over the surface of the waters. And God said, let there be light. So the first thing he did is he separated light from darkness. And that's a theme. And one of the things that I'm enjoying learning about in my old age is that there's these themes that go through the entire Bible. And they start, a lot of them start right in Genesis, and they go all the way to Revelation, and this is one of them. And light and dark is another one. And I don't know if anybody else has ever given a message on that, but that's sooner or later in my life, I will do some more research on that. This time it's on water. But God separated light from darkness. And that theme of the difference between light and darkness and what that stands for carries through with the entire rest of the Bible. And then he says he separates the waters. You've got the waters above from the waters below. All right. And then we get to the waters in the that are below the heavens being gathered into one place. Now, what does that mean? Well, you know, we have continents, right? So we have land, and so there was a separation. And all these things are separation. Separate the water, separate the light and darkness. Now separate the water from the land. Why? So that's useful. You can have some things in the water and some things on the land. And God saw that it was all good. So it's an organization. What we got is God organizing the world to make it useful. And won't go into the next 3 days, but the next 3 days have to do with populating these three areas, the air and the seas and the land, with life. And that's what we see in the next days. Doesn't matter for what I'm talking about today. So the Bible starts with God bringing order, usefulness, to a place that's not very useful in the very first verse there. And the rest of the book is about the tension between this disorder and order. And in one way or another, and I'm going to point out some ways that I didn't do 4 years ago that I've learned since then. As I've read and listened to other people talk about this, I didn't realize other people, well, some of it's much more recent than when I started looking into this. But it's very interesting to see that how this symbolism of chaos is used throughout the Bible. And there's tension because there's God's way, and then there's the way of the goyim, the nations that Jim was talking about. There's two different ways going on here. And the whole Bible's about the tension between them. So it's a story, and it's interesting to me when we get to look at the whole thing. Sometimes, you know, I like to drill down and find these little details here and there. I really enjoy that, as you know. But I also enjoy looking at the big picture and seeing how stories... I'm getting more so that way, where I like to see how a story flows throughout the entire book. And you say the book, you know, it's all, we say there's 66 books, whatever it is, but it's all these different authors, but it all ties together. And it's a story as if it's written by one person, because it is written by God, right? And the stories go through. Okay, so what do we have? We have the earth is not organized, it's not useful, and the organization begins, God does it by separation. He separates the light from darkness, he separates the waters, and he starts organizing the earth to become useful. Why? Because he's going to, you know, it's a place where we're going to live. Mankind's going to live, and that's what we want to share everything with, and that's the plot of the Bible, right? So darkness and waters, right here in the beginning, are symbols for chaos. Symbols for things that are not in order. I like to use the word chaos. Other people like to use it. I think it works. But it's a word that means it's not organized. It's not useful. It's not good for much of anything. And if we go back to Eden, we read that God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish and the seas. So you got all these things that are populated the earth, and all the creeping things. So God puts man in a garden. Now, did Adam and Eve have to make this garden and organize the garden? No, it was already made for them. They got to live in a place that was already made ready for them. And they weren't going to have to work terribly hard. I'm not saying they wouldn't have to work, but things were organized and useful, all right? And God intended, and this is something that I didn't think about in the same way until, I don't know, several months ago, a man gave a sermonette in Columbia. And he said, and I guess it's kind of obvious, but it just never dawned on me before. He said, God put man in the Garden of Eden, man, woman, whatever, and the intention was for them to have dominion over the earth, and the point being that they would spread the usefulness and the wonder of the garden around to the rest of the earth, that humans would spread the Garden of Eden. That's the whole point. And of course the Bible, if you read the whole rest of the book, it's talking about how it's going to be restored in the end. But the initial intention was that Adam and Eve and mankind was commissioned by God. It says make man in our image, right? That means he's going to do what we do, all right? So that was the plan. Of course, what happened? Well, we know that we humans said, yeah, dominion's okay, but we want to do it our way. We'd rather not do it your way. And as a result, as you can see from the carving here, that they got kicked out of the garden. So we chose to live in the chaos. We had the organized place, the garden, that was useful, that God made for us, and we said, nah, rather not. Let's going to go out here. And that's what happened. So rather than helping God expand the garden around the earth, we chose to live in the chaos world. We chose to live there. And God, or here's what he says. He says, you know, for now, you're going to be out on the outside of the garden. It's going to be harder to live here. You're going to have to work hard to get your food. You're going to have to work hard to get what you need. And besides that, you know, you're not going to live as way I intended. You were made from dust, and that's where you're going back to. We're going to start it out. You know, dust isn't very useful just as it is. You got to do something with it. You got to till it to grow plants, or God formed dust to make us. And God's saying, you know, you're going to go back to that. You're going to go back to that state of not being useful when your time is up. So mankind lost the opportunity to represent God in that way and do it his way. We rejected it. We didn't lose it. We just rejected it. We said, no, we want to do it our way. Dominion's always been okay with humans. We're okay with dominion. We just want to do it our way. So God provided an organized and useful garden that could represent him, okay? That's how it started. We chose to leave. We chose to do it our own way. And the Bible uses three major symbols, all right? It uses darkness. How do you make a picture of darkness? So I thought I'd make a picture of an eclipse, I know. But it uses darkness to symbolize this chaos, this untamed place, you know, out there in, you know, space or whatever. It also uses waters. And we're going to talk about that today. And it uses symbolism of desert or wilderness or wasteland, right? You had the, like for instance, during the Exodus, you had the camp, and then on the outside of the camp, that was not God's place there, all right? And you know, there was a distinction between the two. In fact, during the Day of Atonement, they had that one goat, and they made sure they took it out into the wilderness, all right? That's a different place. That's where the chaos is. and tradition has it that they pushed that thing off a cliff so that it wouldn't make it back into the camp. All right, so there's a difference between the camp and wilderness. So that could be another sermon. But that today we're going to talk about water, waters of chaos. And that's the title, if you like titles, those of you that have to write a title, waters of chaos, okay? And we're going to look at how the Bible portrays the seas and also the monsters. And we talked about that in the last time that I gave this, a little bit about the monsters. But I got pictures this time, so I didn't have pictures before. Now, why is all this in the Bible? What are the biblical writers telling us by having all this talk about the seas? Whoops, sorry. All this talk about the seas and about monsters, sea monsters. And we talked about that before. But what is it telling us today? So this is one of the verses that I quoted last time in Job. It says, the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. All right. So in the book of Job, God asks Job some questions when he finally talks to him. And it's interesting that Job finally gets the audience he's been asking for in the whole book when it gets toward the end there in chapter 38. And God says, who's this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? So interestingly enough, God uses in his response to Job one of the symbols of all this chaos. You know, you're in the darkness, Job. You don't really know what's going on. You're in the dark. And what's he say? He says, who enclosed the sea with doors? When bursting forth, it went out from the womb. When I made a cloud its garment, a thick darkness its swaddling band. You know, they used to wrap babies up real tight. I guess, did they really think that the arms would be like not straight if they didn't wrap them up all swaddling? I mean, that's what I read. I don't know if you've learned any of that in your medical courses or whatever, but that's what they used to do, right? They bound babies in such a way to keep everything straight for a while. And I think that's what this word swaddling band is talking about. But who did, you know, he's saying to Job, who enclosed the sea with doors? Like, what's that mean? Well, you know, the sea's here and the land's here. It's got a boundary, okay? It's got boundaries. I place boundaries on it and sea set a bolt and doors and said, don't come. In other words, I'm the one that did this. I organized this. He's trying to make a point to Job, obviously. When he set for the sea its boundary so that the water would not transgress his command. When he marked out the foundations of the earth. You know, wisdom, this is talking about wisdom in Proverbs, but it's talking about wisdom being with God. But this is what God did. God put a boundary on all of this. All right. So the seas are separated from the land. They have boundaries. They're enclosed with locking doors, as if it's got to keep something in or out, right? And it's compared to a swaddling band. Why all of this word picture? What's going on here? What is it about water? In the Psalms, it also says, the voice of the Lord is upon the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Lord is over many waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is majestic. So you have this, there's a symbolism that the writers of the Bible working off of. In the ancient Near East, you had this idea that the seas were symbolic of chaos because you really didn't know what was in the ocean. And, you know, the people that were writing the books of the Bible were not seafarers. And even if you were, you still weren't, as we'll see a little bit later on, just because you did get out in the ocean didn't mean you understood how it all worked. But the seas were symbolic of chaos. And so therefore, in order for a God to be worth his salt, to be a worthy God, he's got to be able to control the seas. And that was just, in all the nations around Israel, that's the thought, all right? We read about Baal in the Bible. Baal is the like the weather god. He is the god in Canaan that can handle the seas, all right? So when Israel's living in Canaan, they got to make sure that everybody understands it's Yahweh that's in control of all that. But the point is he had to be in control because that's what part of the culture. Any god that's really a god and you know is worth worrying about or can be concerned about has to be in control of the waters. All right, so it's a major theme that carries through the entire Bible. And of course that God or Yahweh or Jehovah, as Jim said, is worthy in whatever way any of the nations around them think that a god has to be worthy, Israel's God is worthy. So here's a map. This isn't a terribly old map. This is from the 16th century. But you notice if you look at this thing that I try to press my light, but I never get it too well. Anyway, I want this point. You got all these creatures, right? You got all the, you know, the thing looks like a lobster. This one's like a snake. You got, I don't know what that thing's supposed to look like. You got all these creatures. Because the idea is that we really don't know what's out there. And, you know, ships do go down. and whatever. So it's like an unknown, right? And so people that would make maps back in those days, they draw all these creatures in there. I had one in the basement of my office that I really liked. It had a few sea monsters on it. It's just a world map. And Ever liked it so much it's up in his room now. I don't have it anymore. He really liked it. But for some reason, we want to see put these little sea monsters in there. Because the sea, even now, still has this kind of unknown character to it. And from what I read, I don't have the evidence for this, but it is said that we know more about the other side of the moon that we can't see at night. We know more about the other side of the moon than we know about the bottom of our own ocean. So still a lot of unknowns about our ocean. In the Psalms, we're going to take a look at a couple more here. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we won't fear, even though the earth should change, and even though the mountains slip into the heart of the sea, though the waters roar and foam, though the mountains quake at the swelling pride. So you've got waters roaring and foaming. That's something in a sense to fear, but we don't need to fear because God's in control. All right? If we look at Psalm 77, and when I gave this before, I spent a lot of time and I read some commentaries and so forth about some of these words, and I'm not going to do that this time. But deeps is another one. The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you. They were in anguish. The deeps also trembled. You know, it doesn't matter how deep it is. You know, what we don't know, it doesn't matter because God's in control of it. That's what the psalmist says. And it's said over and over again. But further down, the lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, and your paths in the mighty waters. And your footprints may not be known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So here, this is a psalm talking about the Exodus. And the whole theme of the Exodus is one part of this whole theme that goes through the whole Bible. But God took his people through the sea, right? Safely. But who wasn't that sea very safe for? Egyptian soldiers. So God is in control of all this chaos, and his people are safe and they're okay, but the goyim, the nations that are not his people, they can suffer from this chaos. So God is in control, and he can use the very things that humans look at as being pretty chaotic and scary. He can use those things to execute judgment when he needs to. And he did that on the armies of Egypt as the Israelites came out of Egypt. So he can use them to accomplish his will. Another example would be obviously the flood. You know, the flood, that he uses those powers, if you want to say the power of the seas, against those that are facing judgment. Psalm 93. The Lord reigns. He's clothed with majesty. The Lord is clothed and girded himself with strength. Indeed, the world is firmly established. It will not be moved. Your throne is established of old. You are the everlasting. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. So here's another use of the word, you know, floods. Again, what's a flood? It's out of control water. It's water that's not under control. So that's the picture, and it's painted through the entire Bible. The floods lift up their pounding waves more than the sounds of many waters. Then the mighty breakers of the sea, the Lord on high is mighty, your testimonies are fully confirmed, and so forth. So God is in control of all this. So whether it's floods, whatever the words are used, floods, waters, deeps, all these things are symbols of what seems to be to us to be not under control and somewhat dangerous. What is a flood? Obviously, it's a lack of separation. You know, God put boundaries on the sea. Right, but when there's not boundaries, the flood goes. You know, the waters go where they don't belong. So that's what makes it a bit scary. In Habakkuk, it says here, "Did the Lord rage against the rivers, or was your anger against the rivers, or was your wrath against the sea? You that you rode on your horses, your chariots of salvation, you trampled the sea with your horses on the surge of many waters." So again, it's symbolism saying here, you know, our God is not bothered by any of this. He tramples on the sea. He can walk on it, rest on it, whatever he wants to do. He get the sea, you know, Yahweh, our God, is worthy. He's in control. We don't need to fear. In Jeremiah 51, this is interesting. It shows, it points out the symbolism if you hadn't thought about it before. The seas come up over Babylon. She has been engulfed with its tumultuous waves. Her cities have become an object of horror, a parched land and a desert. Oh, wait a minute. Is it flooded with oceans or is it a parched land and a desert? Well, it's both because it's symbolic. It's gone from being something that's organized to being something that's part of chaos again. And that's the whole point, that whatever it is, whether it's floods, waves, deeps, desert, whatever, it's turned from being something that, that mankind thought was useful to being useless. All right, it's going back in the other direction. So it's obvious here that that these are being used as symbols. They mean something. So it's not necessarily a contradiction. It's, you know, desert or tumultuous waves, either one. They're both symbolic of chaos, the untamed, uncontrolled part of the world. But those places are under God's control. And they're still waiting for their Edenic conditions to be transformed to a Garden of Eden. That's in the future yet. So God is repeatedly portrayed in Scripture as being in control of the waters, or the deep, or the even rivers. Rivers. You know, the, Israel again had to cross the Jordan to get in, right, when they came from the east. So all these things are symbols of chaos, and God, he doesn't have a problem with that. He just solves the problem. He solves the chaos. And if it's water, it doesn't matter. He just leads the people through the water. What about the creatures that are in the water? What about the creatures? This is, according to my grandson, a colossal squid. I thought it was a giant squid. No, it's a colossal squid. I don't know how you can tell. But it's a big squid, all right? And when I gave this before, I spent some time going through the different words that are used in the Bible for the sea monsters, and I won't spend much time on that, but I do want to mention it. Job, when he was being... he was suffering, right? And he's appealing to God in front of his friends there. He's saying, like, what's up? What have I done? You know, he's defending himself somewhat. And then he says, it's interesting in Job 7, am I the sea or the sea monster that you need to set a guard over me? He's using the same symbolism because it was common symbolism in his day. And the word for sea monster there is tanin. That's it's a word that appears in the Old Testament often, and it's translated a lot of times sea monster, or a monster, or whatever, you know, some kind of a monster. In Job 9, God will not turn back his anger. You know, Job was saying, you know, I'm kind of like innocent here, and because God's mad, I'm just getting it, all right? He had all kinds of, he's trying to rationalize what's happening to him. He can't understand. God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him crouch the helpers of Rahab. It's not Rahab, but it's Rahab. It looks like Rahab. And that is another word that's used in the Bible for the sea dragon. All right? For a sea dragon. And this was a common symbol in the ancient Near East of chaos. Yahweh, of course, is in control. He's in control of Tanin. He's in control of Rahab, like, as it says right there. You know, God's not, he is not a problem here. Later on in Job, it says, this is Bildad talking about the God, and he says, he quieted the sea with his power, and by his understanding he shattered Rahab. By his breath, the heavens are cleared. His hand has pierced the fleeing serpent. All right, we got another one here, serpent. Behold, these are the fringes. This is just like the little taste of what he can do. These are the fringes of his ways. And how faint a word we hear of him, but his mighty thunder, who can understand? So now we have something else. We have this serpent, fleeing serpent. And it says it's shattered Rahab. So we have that symbol there, but then we introduce the serpent. Serpent is Nahash. The Nahash. I can't speak Hebrew, but I'm just trying to give you these words so you get a taste for it. And Nahash is something that, again, goes through the entire Bible. And Job is saying here that his hand has pierced the fleeing serpent, the Nahash, okay? Now, where do we know of a serpent? Well, back in Genesis. We all are familiar with that, right? Serpent was the Nahash. Was more crafty than any beast of the field that the Lord God had made. So the Nahash comes into the area that is not chaos, the garden, and tries to introduce some chaos to the humans. So the serpent, you know, instead of get luring the humans out there, the serpent came right in. And that's the way the Bible paints the picture. So you have the serpent. And these creatures are symbols of things that are opposed to God. And that's why they're used this way throughout the Bible. the things, people, systems, whatever you want to call it, that are opposed to God and what he's doing, are painted with these symbols, whether it's an out-of-control sea or the creatures that live in it or whatever. And it appears again and again. In Isaiah 51, "Awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as the days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon?" So we got them all there. "Who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a pathway for the redeemed to cross over." Once again, talking about the Exodus. All right, so God's in control of all that. And the Bible goes back to that a lot. Tanin, Rahab, Nahash, they're all in opposition. But God's in control. And there are other symbols that are used. I spent more time on this 4 years ago. Like Leviathan, right? It talks about that Leviathan is a fleeing serpent. All right, just Nahash again. "With his fierce and mighty sword, even Leviathan, the twisted serpent, he will kill the dragon who lives in the sea." So again, the Bible uses this symbolism for the things that are opposed to God. "You divided the sea with your strength" in Psalm 74. "You broke the heads of the sea monsters," "in the waters. You crushed the heads," plural, of Leviathan. "You gave him as food to the creatures of the wilderness." So it's interesting. I don't, know. This is Gustave Doré's picture of what maybe Leviathan looked like to him. Here's a picture I thought was interesting. Notice this Leviathan has four heads. And we think, that's weird. And we just looked at the verse here in Psalms. It says, "You crush the heads," plural. Why does it say that? Well, I don't know. But the fact is, when we start reading about beasts in the Bible later on, they have more than one head a lot of times, don't they? And so it was not unusual. In Daniel 7, the third beast has four heads. Okay? Revelation 13, beast has a bunch of heads. So these themes run through the Bible from the beginning to the end. And it's neat because there's so many different authors, but the themes are consistent. They're consistent throughout the whole book. Okay. And by saying this, am I trying to claim, well, these monsters are real, that there really are monsters that look like this in the ocean? No, I'm not saying that. I don't think there are. We haven't seen anything like that. But what we have to understand, the Bible does this the same as any piece of literature can and does do very often, uses symbolism to picture things. If I say to you, when you tell me something, and I'm looking like you, like, I really don't believe you, and I say, your nose is growing, what am I saying? What am I saying? I say, your nose is getting longer.
You're lying.
Yeah. Why am I saying? Why do you understand that?
Because Pinocchio.
Is Pinocchio real? No. All right. So we understand that's a cultural thing. That's the way I look at these kinds of things. Do I believe there's literally some kind of a creature like this? No. But it was in the common culture. So what the biblical writers can use that and make a point with it, regardless of whether it's real or not, because it's not a science book. They're trying to describe what God's doing, and they are describing. So I just use Pinocchio. Maybe that's not a really good example, but the point is we can make a reference to something that is fictional to make a point that's real. That's, I think the Bible does that as well. The Bible's not trying to say we got four-headed monsters in the ocean. I don't think. Maybe we'll discover one someday. Don't know. All right. And here's the question I have. We know a lot about these animals, right? We know about the squid. We know about the blue whale. We know about that's a humpback. This is a fin whale, great big long whale. It's in the skeletons down in the aquarium at Baltimore. We know a lot about them, but as I got written up here, is it possible that in our modern world, where we have so much knowledge, deep, detailed knowledge of the world around us, that we can, it's possible, I think. I've done this, that's why it seems real to me. Is it possible that being so realistic and so scientifically oriented that we can miss some of the picture that the biblical authors are painting? Because we can say, they didn't know. They didn't know what the creatures really were like. They didn't know what the oceans really like. It didn't matter. That's what I'm saying. That my 21st century technical mind can miss the big picture because I'm focusing on the little details that weren't important to the story. But what's important is what is the big picture. And I think we can miss, if we're not careful, we can miss the big picture that they're painting. And that's what this particular message has to do with, and the one that will follow next time I come up. Blue whale, from what we understand, is the largest creature that's ever existed on the earth, and it's still here. Bunch of them are. Let's look at Jonah here. And I did spend some time in Jonah before, and I need to mention it again. Jonah 2 says, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the stomach of the fish, and he said, I called out of my distress to the Lord, and he answered me, and I cried for help from the depth of Sheol. You heard my voice, for you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the current engulfed me, and all your breakers and billows passed over me. So we got all this chaos, and not only that, he's stuck in this fish, that he calls it a fish, or whatever the word, some kind of a sea creature. But you see the word depth there? You see Sheol. Sheol is just an understanding of where the dead are. All right, the dead, you die, you're buried. And that is pictured as Sheol. But Sheol's pictured as being down there somewhere. You know, you're down. You're down in the earth. They bury you in the earth, right? And that's the deep. That's the depth. Jonah, what's Jonah saying here? Jonah's like, I'm half dead. I'm on my way down. All right? I'm trapped. That's the whole point of this. He's in the middle of a place he doesn't want to be. And that's why he's crying out from there. So his descent is a literal descent, you know, into the water. But it's also something he's saying, this has to do with me dying. Me dying. Jonah says, I've said that I've been expelled from your sight. Nevertheless, I'll look again towards your holy temple. Water encompassed me to the point of death. This has to do with death, right? The great deep engulfed me. Weeds are wrapped around my head. I descended to the roots of the mountains. The earth with its bars was around me forever. But you have brought me up from the pit, O Lord my God. So he lifted out. Jonah's descent is literal and figurative, both, because it was toward Sheol. And Jonah wasn't the only one. And you say, well, Jonah has a real reason to say these things, right? But there's other people who said the same things that aren't recorded as being in the belly of a fish or a whale down in the middle of the ocean. For instance, if I can get here, Psalm 130, first couple of verses. Out of the depths I have cried to you, O Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications. What's it mean, out of the depths? It's the same picture that Jonah was painting. It's being, feeling like you're dead or pretty near it. And, you know, that can be part of our human condition. In Psalm 69, save me, O God, for the waters have threatened my life. I have sunk in deep mire. There's another one. There's depth. Now it's mire. It's mud. You're quicksand. You can't get out of. And there's no foothold. I've come into deep waters, and a flood overflows me. You've got all these different terms being used that symbolize being in a chaotic place where I can't escape, and I don't like being here. And mire is one that's added here. May I be delivered from my foes and from the deep waters. Deep waters are symbolic of foes. Foes to the psalmist here, foes to whatever God is doing. Okay, so that's the symbolism throughout the whole Bible. This is a symbol, one of the symbols that's used in the Bible for things that are opposed to God and what God is doing. This Psalm 69 is attributed to David. So this is David talking. He likens his foes, the people that are out to get him, to the deep waters. You know, there's something that's going to kill you if it gets a chance. So we got sea monsters. We got the Tanin. We got the Rahab. We got Nakash. All right, we got all these different things. Guess what? Pharaoh. I say, why do I bring Pharaoh in here? And I didn't do this in the last time I gave this because I didn't know it. So I looked up some of the places that the words Tanin, Nakash, and Rahab are all used, right? Speak and say, this is from Ezekiel. Speak and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I'm against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great monster, Tanin. Why do you call Pharaoh a sea monster? Because he's opposed to what God's doing, right? Pharaoh of the Exodus, for instance. That has said, my Nile is mine, myself have made it. I put hooks, this is God saying, I'll put hooks in your jaws and make the fish of your rivers cling to your scales. Did God or Ezekiel think that Pharaoh had scales underneath his armor? No. But it's symbolic, isn't it? Because he's a sea monster. He's like a sea monster. And the fish of your rivers will cling to your scales. And then later on, when not later on necessarily, but when the some Israelites wanted to go to Egypt to protect themselves rather than going to where they, you know, succumbing to whatever the punishment God was giving them. He calls them rebellious children who proceed down to Egypt without consulting me. Even Egypt, whose help is vain and empty. Therefore, I have called her Rahab, who has been exterminated. So now he's calling Egypt Rahab. So Egypt is a major power that's opposed to God, and God uses, or the biblical writers use, terms that have to do with sea monsters to describe Egypt. Can you think of another power in what we call the Old Testament that was opposed to the people of Israel? A serious one, but how about one after them? Babylon. Guess what? Jeremiah 51. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has devoured me and crushed me. He set me down like an empty vessel. He has swallowed me like a monster, tanin. He has filled his stomach with my delicacies and washed me away. So here's Jeremiah comparing Nebuchadnezzar to a sea monster. Now again, nobody believes that Nebuchadnezzar looked like a sea monster or had scales or whatever. But the point is, he's opposed to what God's doing, so this symbolism that goes through the entire Bible is applied to him as well. These are symbols of opposition to God. In Daniel 7, we know these beasts, right? We've studied that people like prophecy, right? Where did these beasts come from? They came out of the sea. Why? Well, because the seas are symbolic of chaos, and these beasts are symbols of chaotic world governments, all right? And what's interesting to me about this, you know, sometimes in our modern world, it's easy to get wrapped up in the beasts a little bit. And I don't mean prophetic. I'm talking about the beasts that exist right now. And we say, we can have a discussion, like, I like the lion, but I don't really like the bear. And other people say, I like the bear, but I don't like the terrible one. The point is, We can get involved in the politics of the world, when from the biblical perspective they're all beasts and they all came up out of the chaos of the sea. And how's one any better than the other one? They're all products of the same thing, and they're all opposed to God, to one degree or another. Doesn't mean one can't be worse. You know, one was dreadful and terrible, as compared to the other. But they're all from the same source, the seas, and yeah, they had their different uniqueness, and some could be worse than others. Then you go all the way to the end of the book in Revelation, and we have a beast there that came up out of the sea, and it had 10 horns and 7 heads, just kind of like Leviathan's described, right? So again, this, and also it talks about a dragon here. These beasts, and it says, and the dragon gave him power over, and his throne and great authority. So the beasts are symbolic, obviously, of world governments, but they're not just symbolic of the governments, they're symbolic of the chaos, the system. That is not God's system, and never has been. Never has been. It's the goyim. It's the nations. It's what God left the rest of the world. You know, they don't want God's way. Okay, He called Abraham, right, and said, "Going to have a people from Abraham," and the rest of the world is doing their own thing, and they are symbolized by these types of things. How about the New Testament? Now you know where I'm going with this. This is obviously supposed to be Jesus sleeping in the front of the boat, right? Now, this is a really interesting story to me, and I'm sure it is to a lot of people. This, by the way, is James Tissot, somewhere in the 1880s or early 1890s, he painted this picture. So here we are in Mark 4. Evening came, and he said to them, "Let's go over to the other side," and leaving the crowd, he took them all along in a boat, just as he was, and the other boats were with him, and there was a fierce gale of wind and waves breaking over the boat. The boat was already filling up with water. I have a couple questions. First of all, who are the people? I don't know. I don't know that it says exactly which guys were manning the boat, but he had at least 4 of his disciples that were fishermen and had fished on this lake their entire lives up to the point that he called them. They knew how to handle a boat in the water. But they were scared. So, like, it wasn't just a bunch of guys out for a Sunday sail. You know, these guys were experienced sailors, and they were afraid. The other question, not a question, that was a point, but the other question I have is, do you think Jesus really needed a nap because he was tired? What do you think? What do I want to commit? I don't think so. I don't think he was sleeping because he was tired. I think he knew he had a point to prove. And this is how it was going to happen. That's what I think. I can't prove that, but Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care that we're perishing?" And he got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush, be still." And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. I think Jesus knew he was going to do that. He had to be asleep. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith?" And then they got really afraid. Because even though, you know, Jesus had told them some things, they didn't really get it. I'm not picking on them. It was hard for them to understand. But they were products of their society and their world. And they knew that the winds and the seas, the waves, were under the control of the gods, were their God. And yet, this guy that we've been hanging out with here just told the wind to stop, and it did. And they were like, "Who is this guy?" They don't get it yet. They're not going to until after the resurrection. But it's starting to like, whoa, this doesn't fit where we want it to fit. And if that wasn't enough, later on, Jesus made his disciples get in the boat and go ahead of him to another side of Bethsaida. And he himself was sending the crowd away and bidding them farewell. He left for the mountain to pray. And when it was evening, the boat was in the middle of the sea. It was out there. And he was alone on the land. He saw them straining at the oars because the wind was blowing the wrong way. So they were kind of stuck in the middle of the lake there. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. And he acted like he was going to pass by them. So what did they think? They thought they were seeing a ghost, right? They supposed he was a ghost, cried out, for they saw him, were terrified. And he spoke to them, said, "No, don't worry, it's me." He got in the boat. The wind stopped, and they were utterly astonished. Well, I guess they were. They just saw somebody walking on the water. But Haggai? You know, it's like, what did the Old Testament say? Who trampled on the water? God did. Yahweh did. The Lord. Capital L's and O-R-D. So here's this guy doing what their Bible said God does. So Jesus is making a very obvious point here, isn't he? So to summarize here what we've covered so far, chaos is the world apart from God's participation to make it better. God's control of everything, all right? Even those things that seem totally out of control, like stormy ocean or sea monsters. Sometimes, like Jonah, you and I could feel like we're as good as dead. But God rescues us. God, you know, that's what he does. That's Jesus' name, right? Rescuer. Savior. So, that's a setup, right? I'm setting something up. I'm also setting up another message. But I want to, and I didn't do this before, so I want to do it now. What can you take home from this for today and tomorrow and this week? Do you have any tanin in your life? Any sea monsters? Any nakash? Any serpents? Do you have any rachab monsters in your life? Well, you do. And I do. God's already shown that he's in control of these things. I mean, I don't know what that monster's supposed to be, but let's say it's fear. Some of us are fearful to one degree or another. I don't know what this monster is supposed to be, but we'll call it worry. Of course, nobody worries, right? We don't have any worriers here. But that's something. That's a monster. How about that one there? Maybe uncertainty. Just like, you know, kind of apprehensive about the future. We don't know. We're kind of concerned or afraid. How about pressure from other people? Peer pressure. We always say that's something that affects young people. Well, it affects old people too. You know, there's always people around you that want to influence what you do, what you think, how you act. It's always there. How about stress? Of course, nobody has stress, right? I have a lot of stress. I wake up in the middle of the night, can't get back to sleep, think about sermons, get some of my best ideas at 2 in the morning, or worst ideas, whatever you think. Get ideas, put it that way. How about anxiety? And you know what? I gave this somewhere, and somebody came up to me afterwards and was talking specifically about anxiety. And she said, you know, it's in my family. It's like, you know, and she says, well, you know, somebody can tell you, just get over it, you know, have faith, get over it. And her point was, and I agree with this totally, is like, you didn't make your own DNA. You didn't make the way you turned out. You didn't control your childhood. So the way you are, and I'm not picking on anybody here, this is a generic statement. The way you are and the way I am is something that, to a large degree, we had nothing to do with. The way we're hardwired. We didn't have anything to do with that. In some cases, we're born with that. Now, I have anxiety in my family. And I never really thought about it until this lady was telling me about her family. I think, well, yeah, I do. I know I do. I know I do have anxiety in the family. And I realized, and I started thinking about my own life a little bit. And I don't need to go in a lot of detail, but as a kid, I can remember being just, I'd go over scenarios in my mind over and over again. My feet would sweat. That's just what it is. And when I would think, oh, what if it goes this way? I said, you know, and I'd work the scenarios. And I didn't think a whole lot of it. Now in my old age, I realize, oh yeah, you know, that was part of my DNA that I had nothing to do with. Because it was other people in my family before me that were like that. Now, that's not an excuse. You know, I still have to deal with it. But I didn't make it happen. I've had friends that have all kinds of issues that are similar to that kind of thing. They didn't have anything to do with it. And I'd say it's true with you too. Yes, we cause a lot of our own problems. We make bad choices. Some of it, though, we're born with. But that's okay, God, because that's part of life, right? I interrupted myself. I don't know what that's a monster. I have no idea what that's supposed to be, but I'm calling that one anger. I've had friends that have anger issues. But you know what? I know their parents. I've heard stories about their grandparents and so on and so on and so on. And you realize, oh yeah, that person might have an anger issue, but they're nothing compared to their ancestors, their parents, grandparents, whatever. Why? Well, we have to deal with that. It's all part of, you know, it's all part of being in the flesh, isn't it? Most of us in here are flesh. And being in the flesh, we have to fight all this stuff. Some of what we're born with, some of it a result of bad decisions, but it's all around us. It's all around us. And you know what? Maybe you're only bothered by uncertainty, but then maybe I'm bothered by anger, somebody else is bothered by fear, and then not only fear, but because I'm fearful, I'm under stress and I have anxiety about it. And so these things start compounding. They start, you know, you're hit with more than one at a time. And I'm preaching to the choir here, you know this. We've all been through things that, you know, it's not just one thing, it's two things, it's three things, and then this happens, and then that happens, and it all piles up. And that's what it does. It's just, it gets to where it's out of control. And we don't know where to turn. But he walks on water. He walks on water. We can get all worked up, and we do. That's where the answer is, because he controls all that. Peace comes through knowing that the Son of God has been there. He's done that. He's been here, actually, to be a little more precise. He came and found out what it was like to live as a human being. And he did what he needed to do, and it's the same things that we need to do, to live here. He's our high priest. He knows what it's like. He promises to live in us through the Spirit so that we can handle these things. Because when it's all said and done, he says, we'll be with him where he is. And there's peace if we know that. There's peace. So what about these waters of chaos? They really do exist. The Bible's full of it from the beginning to the end. What about the sea monsters that are in them? What's going to happen? How's it all going to turn out? Okay. Spoiler alert. I'm going to go to the end of the book and tell you how it's going to turn out. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth have passed away, and there is no longer any sea. I don't remember if I said this 4 years ago, but if I did, bear with me. I do not believe that this has anything to do with whether or not there's going to be an ocean in the new heaven and new earth. I spoke this down in St. Lucia. I said, I come down here, all these other people are here, because they think your seas are really beautiful. And we like it. And you live here and you think it's really beautiful. So we read Revelations, like God said, I don't really like the seas all along. They kind of have monsters in them and stuff. I'm going to do away with those seas. I don't think that's what it means at all. There's a theme that started in the very first chapter of the very first book of the Bible, and it goes all the way to the end of the Bible. And it's a theme of chaos, the waters of chaos. This verse is telling us it's all under control. And when it's all said and done, there's not going to be any more chaos. There's not going to be any more chaos because those things are passed away. Those things have passed away. So you have sea monsters in your life. I have sea monsters in my life. It may be just one that's affecting us. It may be a bunch of them. It may just be being human, of course. You know, that affects us. We live in a world full of chaos, and it's been that way since the Garden of Eden. We're not in Eden, if you haven't noticed. Of course you've noticed. We all notice that. We're not in Eden. Some of you live in Lancaster County. That's almost Eden, okay, but compared to where some of us live. Priya, I did a funeral this week. The lady that did the funeral was for, it's Bonnie's mom. She was born in Danville, Virginia. That's kind of like Lancaster County, I think. And that's where she grew up and where she got married. But after the Depression, her husband had to find work up in the Northeast. And it was over there near Wilmington. And her children there were talking about what a culture shock that was for her. And it's still a culture shock between Danville, Virginia, and what's the name of that place? Anyways, near Wilmington. Because it's refineries and plants. Right there where we were is like a big liquid propane plant that made that for export. There was a refinery right down the street from that. It's just, you know. It's not Eden. It's not Eden. We know that. We live in a world full of chaos. It's been that way all along. But there's hope. Why? Why is there hope? Well, there is hope. There we go. All this stuff is going on, but Habakkuk said the Lord's anger trampled on the sea. He quieted the sea with his power, it says in Job. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent, Job says. He cut Rahab in pieces and pierced the dragon. So all this stuff, yeah, it's real, but the God we worship is on top of it. He broke the heads of the sea monsters, the Psalms tell us. He brought Jonah up from the depths of Sheol. He stilled the storm. He walked on the waters. Yes, he walked on the waters. He walked on the waters. He's been there, and he's done that. Here. He's been here, and he's done that. So you and I can rest and be at peace. The waters of chaos, yeah, they're here. But be at peace. Be at peace. It's all under control.